Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Really, Douglas?
Coming back to the book itself and some of the themes you've picked up on, we've mentioned with the villains that they are more realistic, aren't they? They're not as large than life. Okay, Sanchez has got this amazing charisma, but he was clearly based on, you know, the Noriegas and all those sort of people. The Living Daylights, you've got two realistic villains with different aims and not necessarily, you know, they don't really know what the other one's doing all the time. Yeah, so there's like, there weren't villains with layers, I think you were saying, and it wasn't sort of building up to that classic encounter at the end. Because in Living Daylights, it's sort of done away with killing the main baddie. You've got Koskov, who just goes to prison, and then Whittaker's like almost an add-on mission, isn't it, to kill him?
Yeah, I did watch it, and it always feels slightly disconnected, because the stuff in Afghanistan is so cool. I think they blow a lot of stuff up really well.
They really blow
a lot of stuff, and they still have the gag, so I'm always pleased when a building gets knocked over and there's a naked man in the shower.
It's not a
pigeon double take, but I'll take it, because it is good to see, and so it does feel slightly tacked on at the end. And again, Whittaker, because he's a little undeveloped. Yeah, there's absolutely a desire to just shift that. But I think that was happening somewhat, you know, previously in the movies. They were moving in that direction. For Your Eyes Only, you think that Christatos is the good guy and that flips, and it's actually Columbo. Yeah. So they were trying to embrace more complexity. I just think it feels fully formed with Living Daylights, and then very, very much so with License to Kill. They're settled, and Dalton gives the writers and John Glenn, the director, the ability to have that consistent vision in the movies, because he takes on the realism of the role and the seriousness of the role. And, you know, they're proper thrillers. You don't have Roger Moore's personality sort of pulling against that. It's odd with Roger Moore, because you watch some of his other movies, I don't know, North Sea Hijack or something, and he can be that tough guy. He doesn't have to be. It's just, for whatever reason, in Bond, he thought Spy Who Loved Me was probably peak Bond for him. And so he's always pulling it back in that direction.
Yeah, that's what the fans wanted. Well, that he thought they did.
Well, they made money. I mean, he's not wrong, is he?
Yeah, of course they did.
They did make money relentlessly. So.
But we have mentioned, particularly License to Kill, much more use of violence and even torture from the start. Pretty much the first scene, isn't it? Where Dario and Sanchez are torturing this lover that Lupe is with. And you're like, hang on, this is pretty... Goodness me. A lot of it was cut from the TV version.
Yeah, but it's still bad in the TV version. I remember still thinking the TV version was a bit much.
And it's another, you know, you don't see everything. Yeah. So you see is it a stingray tail or
stingray
something?
Stingray tail.
Yes.
Stingray tail. That's from the Fleming story, yeah.
You don't see it connecting with her, but you see like her face in pain, which is awful. And then later on you see the wounds. And then he says, you know, did he promise you his heart? You know, give her his heart. And then you hear the, you know, sometimes you don't have to show, you know, they do show stuff in that film, but sometimes you don't always have to. And, you know, I think they do that really well.
What did he promise you? His heart. Give her his heart.
No. No, Franz. I didn't mean any harm.
It's all right, baby. No te preocupes, eh? We all make mistakes. Your escapades are getting more creative.
Por favor, Franz.
Not a word.
I think so, and I think that all these things were hinted at in earlier Bond movies. You think about Thunderball, that Largo is going to torture Domino, and he's got the cigarette and the ice, isn't he, or the cigar, and he's, you know, this for heat, this for heat and this for cold, or whatever he says, and it just brings it forward. It possibly, if there's a criticism, does it push it too far for that audience accessibility? Maybe. I think it works in the context of the movie. When Leiter gets eaten by the shark, you get a low angle through the water, and they actually use an amputee for their shark. Yeah. Think, oh, he's got no leg.
Yeah.
Which I never saw on TV. I was watching it, and it still surprises me.
Yeah, it does.
I'm not sure that shot was in the original UK cut. I wonder if that's been...
No, I think I might have heard that that's been added, since then. That was never in the UK, cut.
Because, you know, it was cut slightly differently to kind of...
Hanging on his face is enough, though, isn't it? It's so Edison's awful incredible. To watch. Yeah.
He does really well. It's really nice that we have, at that point, a Felix Leiter we recognise.
Great move, it adds weight
to the role, because as John Terry, who's Living Daylights, is just doesn't really do much, and it's not his fault particularly, but
no, he's my Leiter. Hedison is my Leiter.
Yeah
100%. Yeah, 100%.
I want to go golfing with him. I want to be his best.
well, that's the thing, isn't it? He is the Leiter that you think would be James Bond's best mate.
That's what that dynamic works so much, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Even Jeffrey though he's playing opposite two Bond actors.
Yeah. But he works in Live and Let Die as well, though, doesn't
he? Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
It's so good that it's the same Leiter that in the book incarnations of those two films.
Of course.
I know.
This is the kind of nauseating detail you were interested in. this is
good. This is what we want.
It is violence, and it's much worse than the other ones, but it's not just for violence sake, is it? It means something. No. That's why it's so effective.
And some of it is just adding a bit of blood. You think about when Crest is in the decompression chamber, and that's not that different to Kananga, Mr. Big blowing up.
Yeah.
You know, it has a similarity to that, but it's just, you know, adding a bit of reality, which was that would be messy. And it has a great joke about laundering the money
as well, which
it punctures the violence, and that humour is there to puncture the violence.
And again, that's an example of Sanchez sort of giving the line rather than if Bond had done that, and then Bond said a similar joke.
He's in the water in the background watching it. He just says a line to Pam.
And it's a nice little subtle reference to Goldfinger as well. So Mr. Solo's had his thing, crushed. But then he pulls the money out of the crushed car. It's that same kind of thing, referencing a bad guy, not worrying about his money getting crushed. We'll sort that later. Yeah. We'll destroy the person first.
Yeah.
That's not my money. I swear.
That's right, amigo. It's mine. You think I'm stupid? Huh? You ripped me off, then used my own money to pay someone to kill me? You want it so bad. And take that!
Ah! What about the money, Patron?
Launder it.
Can I ask, Carrie, what you think about Barry to Cayman between the two films?
Yes. I always miss Barry, but I think Cayman does a really good job.
Yeah, we agree. Totally agree.
I always think it's a shame when the main theme is not woven into the movie, and I miss that in License to Kill. Because in Living Daylights, it's done so well because you have all these multiple themes. You have the car theme, but then you have the two Pretenders songs, and it's all woven in, and everything has resonance. And I was listening to your Necros interview with Andreas. I'm not going to pronounce his surname correctly. But, you know, and he has a theme tune. Yeah, he's a killer with a theme tune. Cool. I'm fascinated. I'm going to mention this because I was watching Living Daylights, like I said, at the weekend. And I'm fascinated in a gap between the first time we see Necros at the park in Vienna, the Prater, and you see him in the background with Saunders, and he has a full bunch of balloons. And later on, he only has three or four. So I'm just wondering, how much is Necros charging for balloons? Is he selling these? Does he do this with all his other undercover roles? Is he got like a side hustle going where Necros is making money out of various disguises?
I did it when people get in touch with him, like, and he's like, I don't know, I only do two. I do Milkman or balloons.
That's it.
Yeah.
Which one's going to work here?
Pam and James are living in Jamaica selling fish while Necros is living next door selling milk bottles and
balloons. This is it.
Absolutely.
Andres, did you create this backstory where you were on the moonlighting as that genuine balloon salesman?
That's a real investment for an assassin. That's a real investment in
Like De Niro was a taxi driver for months, you know, before taxi driver was Andreas a balloon salesman.
Well, I was going to say, do all the balloons say Schmitz Bionum, and there's like loads of kids running around Vienna with Schmitz Bionum balloons.
Yeah. Well, you can't say that one. Don't say that one.
Was it like when he saw Saunders, like, hang on, no. He's got the marker pen out, like,
It's a nightmare. Anyway, look, back to Michael Kamen. I think he does a bang up job. I think he brings in the flamenco guitar and those sounds, and he brings in. There's some scenes that do remind me of things like Die Hard, but that's fine. But he uses the Bond theme really well. He doesn't use it excessively, but when he does use it, it works well. And that gun barrel is superb.
Oh, yeah.
It
is
tone, it?
A superb really gun barrel. It's my favourite gun barrel because it's like, how do you surprise people with a gun barrel? Well, that's how you surprise people with a gun barrel. Mm. And it's an amazing moment.
Stakes are immediately high.
So good.
I loved everything he did. There's that track on the soundtrack, License Revoked, which is just every moment of that is just perfection as far as I'm concerned. I will always like the phrase I keep thinking about with Barry is Barry's fingerprint, but I never mind it. I will never ever mind. Anyone who's an artist, you're always going to have a jump off point with your own production, aren't you? You're always going to leap off from somewhere and have your own inspirations. And why not be inspired by Barry, you know? Why ever not? Which is why I really like what David Arnold brought to the Bond world as well. Yeah. I thought, like, while I'm not sure everything completely worked, this goes with the greatest of respect, I thought that the effort was just always absolutely there. And for the most part, came off brilliantly.
I think it's good music. It fits the feel of the film. I think he knows when to put music in. He knows when not to put music in. A lot of the tanker chase doesn't have music and it doesn't need it, I don't think. Mm. So when you get to the Bond theme, when the Kenwood truck raises up, it's real touch the air. It's brilliant, isn't it? It's cool.
And that's a perfect use of Bond music because it's a move that only Bond would probably think Bond. Of. And you know, and as much as it is a dark and gritty film and everything, it does have Bond moments in, you know, just slightly, you know, slightly lighter bits, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I mean, the water skiing scene, which is terrific. It's just full of. And I also love
James Bond.
I love Crest trying to describe it later on, like he's trying to describe it.
Yeah. Like a little bird.
But I love David Arnold, and one of my favourite things about Tomorrow Never Dies is the score. And they decided to put Surrender at the end of the film and not at the start of the film, I will never understand, because the KD. K.D. Langsford theme, I think, is by far one of the best Bond songs of the modern era.
You get both, though.
You do get both, but when you hear the K.D. Lang the start of that where it goes bam 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 wow wow wow, you're just like, that's a Bond film. I know, yeah. I'm in a Bond film. Whereas the other one is fine, but I don't feel Bond film. This looks like a controversial opinion.
No, it's not. No.
It's not a controversial opinion outside of this, but I think Rob's quite a big fan of Sheryl Crow's Tomorrow Never Dies. Yeah,
and... Not at the expense of
no.
human interaction. I do really like Crow's theme. Yeah, but again, I'm not against Surrender. So it's like, as you say, you can have them both. I think Tomorrow Never Dies, as time goes on, will prove to be really underrated across all fronts.
So Surrender ties into the score superbly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like that. Yeah, and again, that's what I was talking about. What I miss with License to Kill. Like that.
I'm
interweaving. And you get it in Live and Let Die, and you get it in Spy Love Me, and you get it with Jared Burnley with Bull Conti's score. They all interweave it. So I think it's a shame when you don't get those. Moment.
Yeah, and I think we did an episode on some of the License to Kill songs. We've done two episodes on the songs of them. It's a song heavy soundtrack.
Dirty Love is genius.
It is.
Dirty Love.
Yes. But that's a great. That's a really interesting Bond scene, because that the James Bond does not belong in that bar. You know, not a bar where they're going to mix you a martini. This is, you know, you can't walk in. And it's a great out of comfort zone. And the music is kind of wrong for a Bond film. I think it's brilliant, but it's...
He's taking his life into his own hands by wearing a cardigan while he's in there.
But it does feel very Bond. It could almost be in a Roger Moore film, couldn't it, though?
Yeah, it's a superb, very 80s piece of...
Yeah, Michael Kamen, he's written so many songs for films, like for Robin Hood. Mm. And, you know, it's just... It's incredible to think that there could have been a Bond song written by him somewhere. Well, but I don't know whether he was called in later because John Barry was unavailable.
This missing theme that was written by Eric Clapton.
And yes,
I don't know if Kamen was involved. Yeah. So Kamen and Clapton worked together, I think, on Lethal Weapons 3, don't they?
I think all of them.
All the Lethal Weapons, they worked together. And they did something for License to Kill, and the producers said no. And it had Dick Flick, the guitarist that John Barry used in the 60s, was on the soundtrack. Yeah. And I've never heard it. I'm not aware that it's available anywhere.
No.
Years ago, there was a terrific CD of music which had alternatives, and it had, you know, things like Mr. Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, the different versions, and the Anthony Newley original recording of Gold.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But never heard the Clapton, whatever it is. Mm. And you're just like, I kind of want to see this. I need to hear this. Where is this? But I think License to Kill, the Gladys Knight theme is fine. That came as a package, so that was the music for the movie, the songs, not the Kamen score. License to Kill, Patti LaBelle's song, If You Ask Me at the End, Dirty Love, and The Wedding Party.
Never
forget that classic.
They all came as a package from a music publisher. They were like engaged by it, so they all came sort of together, and then we then used in the movie. So it's more of a contractual arrangement. But it is a shame, because I'd loved to see... did he co-write I Hate to Say It from Lethal Weapon 3 that Sting sing?
Yes, yeah.
That's great. I could.
I hate to say.
That's terrific. Yeah, so I could have, that would have been cool.
Oh, yeah, he's done loads with Brian Adams particularly. Yeah, All for Love as well, so from Three Musketeers. But yeah, at least for the If You Ask Me To, we get the recall of the line, don't we? That is incorporated into the script, which is like the callback, which is quite nice.
What do we think about? I need to ask this because I'm 100. Oh. I'm so divided on the winking fish.
Oh,
is the winking fish a masterstroke, or is
it's
it
too
a
iconic.
Odd an odd moment at the end of the movie?
It's hard to analyse now. Yeah,
we're not objective.
Nobody's ever asked you about your winking fish before.
No.
It has never bothered me.
Yeah.
It's just never bothered me. I've just been overwhelmed by 2 hours of. Masterclass. And we've got Patti LaBelle going on in the background, which I'm not the biggest fan, but I have to confess, since doing this podcast, I have appreciated it far more because it comes up in pretty much every conversation. But no, to be honest, the winking fish, I give it a pass. It's fine. It's all right.
That's fair play.
And the other fish, of course, that when he wakes up in Sanchez's bed. Yeah.
Oh, that's frightening.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a weird moment. Yeah.
Very fish strange. Out of water, symbolism.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a wonderfully surreal moment, though, isn't it, when he wakes up there?
I think we should just sort of talk about some of the key actual scenes in the two films. So if we start with the Loon Daylights, you mentioned that Timothy Dalton wasn't quite ready, was he? He wasn't on board until later in the day. So they'd already filmed some of it. Yeah. But I think it works really well that you don't see Bond for quite a while. In the same way, George Lazenby in On a Majesty's Secret Service.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm sure I've read Glenn saying that he wanted to imitate that. He wanted to
bring him.
But it's all action. It's a wonderful thing because he doesn't speak until he's on the you know.
Yeah.
It's all about physicality and movement. And Dalton did a lot more of the stunt work than the producers will have wanted him to out there with the second unit and they're throwing himself around on the top of that Land Rover.
Yeah.
And you just get intensity. Yeah. You know, when I watched like Living Daylights again, I really noticed his eyes. He does so much work with his eyes as an actor. It shows you what he's thinking constantly and his emotionality and it's a physical opening, isn't it?
Just on his eyes. I think I've heard it before, but I know, you know, on James Bond radio when they like talking about Tim and everything, like those wolf eyes, you know, he's like a wolf.
He did a documentary about wolves, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. Yeah. I remember that.
Rob, you're gonna bring out one of your Dalton pictures now.
Would you like
from your office? Well, I think it's about time, isn't it?
Now, why didn't you wait until you're out?
It's a beautiful thing.
That's James Bond, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's my James Bond. It's not everyone's James Bond, it's my James Bond.
I think that pre-title sequence, I mean, it might be a future episode that we do, the best pre-title sequence, I think.
Probably. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
But I think The Living Daylights is right up there because it's introducing Bond. It's really clever how you know, I mean, we know who it is, but you know, objectively, sort of, you don't know who could be Bond, and then it's both linked to the main plot of the film, but also like an action sequence with a beginning, like and an end in its own right, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
and I just think it's terrific, and you do really feel that it's Dalton, you know, that he's the man. It's not, you know, bless him. It's not Rod. You know, it's not stuntman in a brown wig. you know, you feel that it's Dalton hanging off the side of a Land Rover on the side of a, you know, the incredible Rock of Gibraltar. So, yeah, I think it's right up there.
You know, he gets a woman at the end of it for all the talk of monogamy and stuff. I mean, the very first.
Yeah. Yeah, but you don't actually see him like kiss or anything, which I think is interesting.
And sorry, love, no, don't talk.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
And he doesn't seduce her or anything of the sort.
Yeah,
she's just saying about all the old tennis pros. And
John, I felt a little, you know, a little.
Yeah.
Amorous intention of my own there, John.
Well, it is Friday night anyway. Yeah, and it's like, I need to use your phone very quickly. And, and even though he says Bond, James Bond, he's completely disinterested, isn't he? He's like, I'm getting on with the mission.
Yeah.
So involved in the mission,
He's so, and she's just attracted to him because he's a real man. You know, that's what she
says.
Carrie, is it better make that two or better make that two?
It really does sound like it to me.
Well, better than make that two.
Is that
2 hours, definitely. Yeah.
But it does sound like he says that's, you know,
Better make that two. Does he?
You'll have to watch it again.
You'll have to.
Reason to watch it again.
I watched the whole pre-title sequence. Watch the whole thing.
Well, I will. That's the problem. That's another 2 odd hours gone.
The way he's introduced, though, like the head turn to the Bond theme, it's just instantly right. That's it. Yeah. I love him.
And also, helpfully, you've already had M, which is the same M, you know, Robert Brown's M.
Yes.
To already put you in that place that this is Bond.
And I actually think the relationship, Robert Brown really comes into his own with Dalton.
Yeah.
He's fine in the others, but you kind of, Bernard Lee's shadow is just lurking. But with Dalton, their relationship feels very different and very developed. Much more antagonistic, which is really interesting.
That goes on to one of the themes in your book. You say that a bit like Daniel Craig's Bond now, he's far less likely to listen to authority. Whereas Roger Moore was always, he annoyed the whole time, but he always respected him. He wouldn't want to upset him. Bernard Lee especially respected him, didn't he? But now we've got, you know, if he fires me, I'll thank him for it. And
a lot
more bristly, isn't it?
He is, and I get there's almost an element of self-loathing that comes in here to the job and the work and the difficulty of it. Because, you know, Dalton's Bond does know that he's a killer, and that is not a nice thing to be. Mm. So, again, there's this tension or contradiction in his character where there's this thing he does, and you know, he's doing it for Queen and Country, and in License to Kill, he's doing it for personal reasons. But at the same time, you know, it's a nasty business. Whereas with Roger Moore, you kind of, Roger Moore kills people in the most gentle way possible. In this extent. But, you know, Roger Moore's Bond, and I know there are exceptions, but you think about Moonraker or Spy Who Loved Me, he doesn't feel touched by any of it. It doesn't, you know, this is not a man who's going to drink, you know, a bottle of vodka afterwards because he's
yeah,
you know, well, he's just down in the bar finding another woman to spend some time with.
Them. Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
that is a little
5 days till I check out. Roger, good stop, luck, please.
Roger,
it's a long time, isn't it?
What a laugh.
There was something you mentioned, Kerry, that I've been desperate to ask you about.
Is, okay.
You felt that when Dalton has finished in License to Kill, that there's a finality there to that series of the, or that portion of the franchise, and that everything from that point is from another jump-off point and another incarnation of the character.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not. I'll just be clear, I'm not going down the it's different people with the same code name thing.
Oh,
so.
No, I never inferred
that. That's not for you, like, but it's just like, it's a crazy idea.
Yeah, it is,
If it wasn't for Desmond Llewellyn in GoldenEye, I would say that was a reboot, GoldenEye, because it feels so different. And that's not a criticism, but if he's the only, you know, sort of holdover, I know Cubby Broccoli was involved, but he was quite ill by this point, so it's pretty much a new producing team. Mm. There is an interesting circularity if you think about Dr. No and all the way to License to Kill, and I talk about the guns in the movie a bit. Because Dalton and Bond has a Wolf of PPK, and he gets that in Dr. No. He has a Beretta 2.5, which is the gun from the novels. And Fleming used that gun until the real Major Boothroyd wrote him a letter and said, you know, that's a lady's gun. And Fleming's like, okay, what gun should I have? And so he changed the guns. The gun sort of represents Bond's legitimacy, and it's a symbol of power. You can get quite Freudian about these things, but it's an extension of his job. The point where M in License to Kill wants to take it off him, and he refuses, it's a powerfully symbolic moment. It's sort of the father figure trying to take authority back, and Bond saying, no, I'm going to keep this. And then eventually he loses that gun, Sanchez takes it, and he ends up with a Beretta, which is a very similar model to the one. And it's almost like we've gone back, and he's, you know, I talk about him symbolically sort of growing up, but he's detaching from the father figure and doing what he wants. He's making his own decisions. And that's a very different thing for Bond to do. And I think it does sort of create a certain circularity. It does signal the end of a lot of those people being involved in the movies. And Richard Maybaum as well, the screenwriter. Mm. That's the, you know, he's been pretty much there all on, not quite on all of them, but pretty much on all of them. It's like his last one. Maurice Binder's last time he did the title sequence.
Yeah.
So it does feel like the end. And there's a funny Dalton quote I didn't put in the book, but I saw it where he was in an interview and he said he felt like this was the last one when he made License to Kill. He said, just had a feeling that somehow this was the last one.
Wow.
And it's a really interesting, and I wish I'd put it in. I don't think I saw it at the time. I thought I saw it later. It's bloody typical. But a sense with, Bond's character goes out on his own and does his own thing and doesn't need those things. But you get the phone call. I always find the phone call with Lighter. Lighter's always a bit too cheerful at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, I'm here with one leg and half an arm and my wife's dead, but, you know, how, James, how are you doing? But enough about me. And how are you? Because we never see Dalton's Bond sort of go back in with them. It's sort of like, Bond's out now. And it feels like that. And maybe he's on the beach with Pam and I'm buying into this now.
I've got full buy-in now on this. The more I'm thinking
So
that James Bond.
And, you know, Brosnan's Bond, there are very few callbacks because we don't get Felix, for instance. We never mention Tracy unless I missed some sort of
reference. No,
but other than the naval uniform makes a reappearance, the sort of Commander Bond stuff. It feels, you know, even the MI6 building is completely different. We're in the new offices. Yeah.
And he's got his own allies. You know, he's got, there's Judi Dench's M, there's Michael Kitchen's Tanner, there's Colin Salmon as Charles Robinson, Zakovsky. So, it's all like
now, I believe that Zakovsky might originally have been Pushkin from Living Daylights and it was rewritten.
Right.
I believe Pushkin was going to be in GoldenEye when Michael France was writing screenplay and the character evolved.
Wow.
That would have been really, of course, if Dalton had come back, that would have been cool, but they changed it. And Zakovsky's great. So,
you get two great characters. The whole wanting a new actor, particularly for the studio, I think you mentioned in your book the fact that the prequel to GoldenEye is set in 1986.
Yeah, if you did the math.
Was that done as a tribute sort of to his missing chance? poo-poo the Dalton era, we hope.
I've no idea what the writers were thinking. It's interesting because it allows them to go back into a Cold War scenario, and it also draws attention to the Cold War. And it's the GoldenEye title sequence is great with all the women bashing the image of Stalin and Lenin. Symbolically destroying the end of the Cold War. So there's an element of that, but it's just sort of if it's sort of like, oh well, yeah, we're gonna skip forward and ignore those two great adventures you had, and it's like the Brosnan's the new Bond and he should have always been Bond, and a lot of people thought that, of course. So yeah, I guess you could argue, you know, there's an element of that. I always just thought it was odd that it goes back to then, but it skips out my Bond, and I want my Bond. I don't want my Bond skipping out. My Bond's integral to these things. So yeah, it's just a personal view on it. I have no idea what the scriptwriters would
think. We've got to talk about a guy that we've talked about nearly every episode, and I think it defines the whole sort of, I don't know, just Bond's the character arc and his growth, especially on the mission. It's got to be Saunders, hasn't it?
I think it's really that such a side character does have such growth and a clearly defined arc, and he isn't just disposable. So when he does die, and it's a nasty death.
Oh, horrible.
Apparently they filmed something that implied he'd been cut in half. Oh. And the actor was there and covered in ketchup or whatever all day, and it was all cut out. And there was going to be a line when the stretcher was brought in. Dalton was supposed to say, I think you need two. But
that's two. Jeez. No, sorry, that's not two.
You get the bad accident back there. So good.
Yeah, but it's a great moment because it means Saunders' death means something. Because we've had a little journey with him from being, you know, a bit of a stuck-up arse to actually softening and understanding Bond and becoming round to being a decent guy. It's also really good detail that somebody on Twitter shared the other day where Dalton drinks the coffee in the cafe and he pulls a face like this.
Yes, I saw that. That was really interesting.
Crap I have ever drunk in my
Such
life.
Such good acting.
What a wonderful little moment just to throw that in. It doesn't mean anything, you know, the plot, but it just gives us a little bit of Bond would hate that coffee. So, yeah. He hates the coffee. So
yeah, that definitely feels like something Dalton brought than a direct, a note or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely, very much.
Where's Whitaker now? At his place in Tangier. Well done. Good luck. Saunders. Thanks.
He's with Whitaker in Tangier.
Brad Whitaker? The American?
You know him.
He's a patron of the arts. Georgi said he'd help me. How soon do we have to go?
Immediately. I promised Georgi I'd get you back as soon as I could.
Can't we stay here a few days?
No. We leave first thing in the morning.
His reaction to the death is one of the best scenes, isn't it?
I love when he jumps over and he's got the gun pointed at the kids. Absolutely. And that rage actually, you know, then has, you know, it echoes in License to Kill. So we see that power. Yeah.
Yes.
When he bursts the balloon and everything and the anger, you know.
Oh.
I mean, I can't imagine Roger really doing that. That or any of them previously.
No.
I mean, like,
anger, but not absolutely losing it.
Roger did some really effective ways in terms of, let's say Ferrara and how he kicked Locke over. And he also was really emotional towards VJ. But what you see from Dalton is just sheer rage.
Yeah. It is. And it's like he's there because he's not thinking about anyone else that's there at that time. You know, it's just him and the balloon almost. And...
Oh, yeah.
It's very powerful. Again, it's that's his acting style and that's what he brings to it. But that's, you know, the directors, nobody just going, yeah, go for it. Let's do that. And they, you know, they advertised that movie as the, you know, the new James Bond, Living on the Edge, or The Most Dangerous Bond Ever was the other one. It's like, yeah he is.
Yeah,
he is. Looks like it.
The sort of contrast, though, you get very much from the last few Bond films would be like the cello chase. Mm. That does feel like it was ready-made set piece for whoever was going to be Bond. And Dalton, I don't know, he's game, isn't he? He can do those scenes.
I think he has a lot of fun, particularly in daylight. See, yeah, it's not that he can't do it. It's just that it's not maybe what he wants to do with the character. But they sit in that cello case. They have a lot of fun. It's a great fun scene, and the car chase is great. And the, you know, it's great to be back in a really cool Aston Martin and all those sorts of moments. And he does have fun with that. Yeah, so he can do the lighter stuff, and it plays and cuts really well when they throw the cello over the border crossing and waving the passports and stuff.
Glad I insisted you brought that cello.
So the lighter side is there, and then we move into the romantic side. So there's different aspects to his Bond that he plays off, and he switches between them really well. So, you know, actually the scene with Saunders' death comes after the Ferris wheel, comes after the actually kind of kiddie-ish, you know, the guy who runs the Ferris wheel is making fun of them when they go off.
Yeah.
It's cute.
You want another line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just think about all these emotions, though, that Dalton is doing. It's so good.
It is. It is. It's brilliant.
John, your favourite scene, you think, in Living Daylights, when he storms in on Pushkin and basically doesn't trust him, does he?
When I think of Dalton's Bond, there's a few, but I think that this is the one that sums him up most perfectly, because I think you've got that absolute rage. You can see he's a killer. Mm. He is a spy here. The whole use of Pushkin's wife, stripper naked, absolute no respect, use her as the distraction. But you can see he's got his pointing the gun at Pushkin, but you can almost see the conflict in him in terms of, I've got my orders, but I'm not entirely sure this is it. And I think that scene is absolutely outstanding. I think it's helped that you've got a phenomenal actor playing off him in John Rhys-Davies as well. I think, you know, they're superb. And I think it always helps when Dalton's got the baggy beige suit on as well.
It's so crisp. Yeah. But also John Barry's music as well comes
in.
Yes. It's another different use of the theme, the Living Daylights Aha theme, but it's, you know.
It is true.
It works so well.
Is anything wrong? Don't make any sudden moves, General. Go to the table. Sit down. I take it that this is not a social call, 007. Correct. You should have brought Lily's. May I ask why? Smiertspionem. Smiertspionem was a Beria operation in Stalin's time. It was deactivated 20 years ago. Two of our agents are dead. My condolences. We had nothing to do with it. Where's Koskov? He disappeared 2 weeks ago. I was about to have him arrested.
Why?
For misusing state funds.
Involving Whitaker?
That is a security matter and cannot be discussed.
That was damn stupid! Get in the bathroom and lock the door. Stay where you are. Now get down on your knees. Put your hands behind your back.
You are professional. You do not kill without reason.
Two of our men are dead. Koskov's named you. Why should I disobey my orders?
I am in the dark as much as you are. It is a question of trust. Who do you believe? Koskov? Or me?
If I trusted Koskov, we wouldn't be talking. But as long as you're alive, we'll never know what he's up to.
Then I must die.
It pinpoints him and he handles the gun well, and you got the silencer on the
yeah.
water. And,
oh, silencer.
And he's just willing to be pretty brutal, you know, when he tells Pushkin he's been damn stupid.
Yeah.
And,
you know, and,
yeah.
And then he's still like down on your knees, and it's so cold.
It really is. He's aware his whole life is a compromise, I think, Dalton. Mm. He knows that every action he takes is just a compromise of his own position morally and his own government's position. This is the thing that I've really missed, is the respect and love for, which I always felt was prevalent in especially Moore and Sean's movies, was that he's doing it for Queen and Country. Mm. Dalton was very hell-bent on that same mission, but he knew it came with a cost.
No, I think that idea of compromise is a really interesting one. And he also respects Pushkin. We talk about that. You know, he is conflicted because he's dealt with Pushkin. Pushkin's a decent guy. He's on the opposite side, but he's a stand-up sort of guy. So you don't want to kill this guy. And of course he doesn't. And they have that great scene where, you know, he shoots Pushkin. Absolutely perfect. Brilliant shooting. You know, I've never been grateful that James Bond is such a good shot or whatever.
Yeah.
Pushkin says.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Again, it's conflict and it's nuance to the character. It's he doesn't just do what he's told. He's thinking about it, you know, because we know that Johan Krabbe's character, whose name has literally just disappeared from the...
Koskov.
He's clearly a slimy git, so we know
that. Yeah.
He's dodgy. So, yeah, it works really well, that scene. Professional killer, absolutely, 100%. But I think that when he's handling that ridiculously huge Walther rifle he's got.
Oh, what a scene that is.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
But, and I just shout, can we bring back the little tuxedo that folds over?
Oh, yes.
Instant assassination.
Love one of those.
It's fantastic that you get it back in License to Kill. It's a little trademark adult that he has. And I think...
It's espionage.
Yeah, it is. This is a guy who...
From Rush With Love type era.
Absolutely.
And the stripping over of the strap is always complemented by the wolf eyes. He's absolutely glaring both times he does it.
It's almost like he flicks a switch. And I'm in killer mode, and I'm gonna ruthlessly kill people. And you know,
so he sees Kara though.
Yeah,
yeah, crucial. What are you waiting for, Bond? Shoot her.
Yeah.
the other big character in Living Daylights is Necros, and of course Bond doesn't really come face to face to him properly until the end fight, which is just, we mentioned the physicality of Dalton in the opening sequence, and this is just. It's so good, isn't it?
It is good. And it's really well cut with the stunt work that they did in the location at the back.
It's taken so long to do that, isn't it?
And it was very, very dangerous. If you look at any of the making of stuff, it was really risky, particularly once they released all the bags to come out, and there was no weight in it. You know, Dalton's there. I know we talked about this sort of at the start, didn't we? Where the physicality of Dalton is convincing. He doesn't have to be this sort of Superman body guy. I believe he's there fighting. But also the fact that he isn't sort of that, like, there's more risk as well, because it looks like it's difficult. You know, you think about Skyfall is that, you know, Craig has, you know, been shot in the shoulder and he still manages to hang off that elevator or lift or whatever, the going up the whole tower.
Yeah,
it's just like that is so too much, maybe.
Yeah, superhero, but, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Whereas Dalton, you know, because of the sort of, you know, he's a physical guy, but he's not a superhuman guy. So there's always that sense of threat going through. And that's a really interesting thing. And it's a great fight. And the guy who plays Necros, he does a really good job. And because he comes from a ballet background, the fight, I love the fight he has at the Bladen.
Yeah.
Estate
yeah.
when he
oh,
comes
yeah.
in,
absolutely.
With Green
yeah,
Four.
Green Four, yeah.
Green Four's a base. And oh. That's a great fight.
Yeah. And something that's so good that I love about that is that it sets up, you get the yeah. feeling, right, maybe Bond's going to have to come up, you know, against this guy at some point, you know, all the way through. I mean, whether you think it or not, but then as soon as you, as soon as he reappears well. In the plane, you're thinking back, well, you know, what he did in the kitchen, you know, I really like that.
Yeah, no, it's really.
And they're not silly fights with like punch, punch, back, forth, but they're like quite difficult, realistic, you know, like strangling, getting yeah. caught in the net. And
yeah.
you really feel like that both are putting their all into
it. Yeah, and they bring the environment of the fight in
yes.
into it, you know, and the implements of the kitchen and the, you know, the different.
Oh.
And then very different places, the back of it, an open plane and everything.
Yeah.
It's tremendous.
There was really good stuff, and there's real threat to it, and there's real anxiety. And I, you know, in the back of your mind that Bond's not going to lose, but we have to tease that he might lose for us.
Yeah.
I'd love the payoff, you know, with, you know, he got the boot.
Yeah.
Which it's brilliant.
And they say Dalton can't do humour. That's bloody brilliant.
Good. The myths of James Bond.
Yeah, absolutely.
A new series. License to Kill. I mean, we touched upon all this to start with, but I think you did mention one. We've touched, you know, gone into detail. I think you say at the start of the film, it's quite different to see Bond in a normal setting that we have. So he's at a wedding with his best mate and his wife to be.
Who knew Bond had friends? You know,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, other than what, Live and Let Die, when we see his Chelsea apartment and he. Has that ridiculous, you know, the coffee. I love the coffee maker. Is that all it does?
Yeah.
Says, that's great. We'd never really see much about Bond's life. So to see him out of context at the wedding, being friends with people and you know.
Yeah.
Is it me or is Della slightly too affectionate?
Oh,
well, yes. There is this.
Oh, yeah.
Where
yeah.
do we begin? Where do we get started here?
Yeah.
Open mouth kisses with the bride. I'm not on my, you know. To-do list when I go to a wedding.
Yeah, it was, yeah, so, you know, but yeah, she's a loving woman, clearly. And, you know, but it is affectionate and there's real warmth between him and Felix. And again,
yeah,
having David
yeah.
Hedison helps with that, I think, because it sort of has a shorthand relationship, doesn't it? So, yeah, it's interesting to see. And it's, again, it's about moving Bond out of the comfort zone, you know, him as a character, but us as an audience to a certain extent, because we don't expect to see him. There.
Yeah.
And it does develop in and it does flesh out the background to his life that he is a person when he's not on a mission. There is something else going on.
Yeah. And it works quite well. That, now, thinking about it again, it's set against the end of Honor Majesty's is at the wedding. The start of this is at the wedding. What happens at the wedding or after it is the source of revenge.
Mm.
Of course, you said it should have happened in Diamonds Are Forever or whatever, but. Yeah, because every time I watch it, I'm having a good time at the wedding. I'm still like, how good's this?
Yeah.
I'm never like, oh no, what's about to happen? I know what's coming. I'm just like, this is such a realistic almost.
Well, it's a very wedding. Hedonistic affair, isn't it? I mean, yeah, like people are diving fully clothed into fountains.
How can you not enjoy this when wedding parties blasting out in the background?
Yeah. I mean, I wonder what the agents are getting paid, or maybe Dell has the money. I don't know, but somebody's putting on a really lavish display here. I don't know.
Yeah.
If secretly Light has been dealing on the side with some of the
yeah, of course he has.
Yes. Yeah, the extra powder, you know, from the job. But
no. My partners at the DEA.
Yeah, no, it's cool, and I love Killifer as well because he's such an annoying character away.
Mom,
a terrific performance. Yeah, he puts him back right up.
He gives nice like character beat and everything.
Yeah,
he gives him Bond a little like punch in the shoulder and like he looks at his doesn't he? Yeah. I've seen the film.
Yeah,
it's such a contrast between. You know how
Bond's onto him, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the red wine with fish. It's just there's something wrong with this guy. You know, he's doing things in the incorrect way, and so it's a good performance. The I can't remember the actor's name who plays Killifer. He's in Twin Peaks.
Yeah. Everett McGill.
Everett McGill.
Yeah, really, the way he's sort of done away with is so good. Again, that's the revenge. It's revenge part one, isn't it?
Yes.
Because he's the betrayer to start with, isn't he? You could say you could almost be more annoyed with him than Sanchez, really.
Oh, God, yeah. No, absolutely.
Oh,
For Sanchez, it is just business. This is what he does for Killifer. Yeah. I mean, he's betraying somebody he knows. He's been to his house, you know. He's just come over to kiss the bride and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, I know she kisses a lot.
The way he says it, kiss the bride.
Yeah, the cigar.
Hasn't he got a cigar? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Can we just hold it, Killifer?
I know he says he's obviously shocked that what's going to happen to Felix because doesn't he suggest that, oh, right, I didn't think you were going to kill him. Or there's something, isn't there, where he turns away. You can't
He pukes, doesn't he? He's basically going to go and puke. And he's like...
He's a coward, isn't he?
You know, $2 million is a hell of a chunk of dough, as he says.
Yeah.
He's just been bought off and again, that contrast, you know, the ideas of loyalty and money and all those things, the themes that are sewed in through the movie.
This is where you put your old buddy Felix. Not me. Chalk that one up to Sanchez and Crest. $2 million in that suitcase. I'll split it with you. You earned it. You keep it, old buddy. No!
It's a great fight scene, I think, in when Bond, you know, comes up into the Crest's fish area with all the it's a really good scene that uses the environment really well as well.
Mm. Yeah. Electric eels portrayed well on screen for the first time ever.
Finally.
Yeah. Some of us have been waiting years.
I mean, we keep going about it, but the acting of Dalton when he... Obviously, Felix mentioned his wife. He was married once, but then when he finds Della, it's just we've not seen this before, have we?
No, we've not. And you know, death suddenly means something very personal.
Yeah.
And you've mentioned VJ in Octopussy, but you know, okay, he's dead, and then we move on. So we have a moment, don't we, to think about it? But it doesn't really pay off. But yeah, the emotionality. I love the moment where he sees the buttonhole flower. When he's with Chris, and you just see his face sort of darken, he just worked out what's gone on.
Yeah,
and again, the very subtle emotions. I mean, he's deeply distressed about Della, and really shocked when he finds Felix. I mean, you know, real distress. And again, it's an emotional depth we don't associate with these movies. So certainly not up to that point.
So agree.
So good,
Felix.
How
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Della!
Felix.
Hey, Leiter, where you been?
It's Bond. Get an ambulance here, quick.
The M scene in Hemingway House, I've never thought about that before, but again, it's more symbolism. The fact that, like you said, of course, the sort of father figure taking away the gun and all that symbolism, but also M's presented as the baddie then. It's like he's going to his lair with the cats, and he's almost like Blofeld inspector. Never thought about that before.
Mm. Well, it's just interesting. It's just you throw the cats in and somebody stroking. You know, it's like
And you don't see him, do you? And he turns around.
So and they're playing with the audience, definitely playing with the codes to the audience there. And it is deeply antagonistic. It's a moment where Dalton's Bond just refuses the sort of paternal authority that and. Represents. M's a really interesting nickname because apparently it was Fleming's, what he called his mother. Reading that somewhere, maybe in the Andrew Lissett biography or something years ago, and it's like that adds all sorts of interesting textures to this relationship. But we've always had respect and actually some affection between, Bond and M. And the worst it ever really gets is on Her Majesty's Secret Service, but Moneypenny smooths it out and sorts it out. And at the wedding, M is pretty happy. I love how he in the wedding is exchanging notes with Drago about it's a really nice Very moment. Crisp. But I do think Robert Brown's M definitely comes into his own in Dalton's film, and particularly in License to Kill. He's given some real dramatic stuff to chew on. Mm. And he's clearly a professional, and to a large extent he's right. Bond's doing the wrong thing.
But he does still care though, God help you, Commander. He does still despite all that, and he doesn't want them to shoot at him, so he's still protective of him.
Yeah, absolutely.
You were supposed to be in Istanbul last night. I'm afraid this unfortunate lighter business has clouded your judgment. You have a job to do. I expect you on a plane this afternoon.
I haven't finished here, sir.
Leave it to the Americans. It's their mess. Let them clear it up.
Sir, they're not going to do anything. I owe it to Leiter. He's put his life on the line for me many times.
Oh, spare me this sentimental rubbish. He knew the risks.
And his wife?
This private vendetta of yours could easily compromise Her Majesty's government. You have an assignment. and I expect you to carry it out objectively and professionally.
Then you have my resignation, sir.
We're not a country club, 007. Effective immediately. Your license to kill is revoked. And I require you to hand over your weapon. Now. I need hardly remind you that you're still bound by the Official Secrets Act.
Farewell to arms.
Don't get too many people.
God help you, Commander.
Of course, it's hinted at the end that it'll all be all right and that M's got work for him and all those sorts of things.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's antagonistic, but there's still the undercurrent of warmth there as well, which comes out later on. But he's exasperated. We see that in the brief Money Penny scene just before she phones Q Branch, where you know better than that. Me. He's gone after Sanchez and he's got to be stopped because you know M has a department to run. You know, he's got a job, bless him. And so there's that again tension between wanting to. You know, Bond to be Bond, but also he's supposed to obey orders. That's his job.
Have you seen that meme, Carrie, where there's a I know this is ridiculous opening to a question, but there is two kids in a swimming pool with a dad and one kid is drowning.
Oh yes,
one is being held up. And the captions are, the one that's being held up is the Daniel Craig era. Is labelled the Daniel Craig era. The one that's drowning is labelled Timothy Dalton, and the one that's holding him up is labelled something along the lines of Bond fandom. Yes. Because to me, everything I'm seeing at the moment in the current era of Bond has been done before, but done so much better in License to Kill.
I mean, I would agree, generally speaking, because the humanity, the emotionality, the physicality to a certain extent, it's a slightly different physicality, but the idea that Bond can get hurt is there. But I think when you look at Craig's one, in Casino Royale, there's this rawness to his Bond. He's not Bond yet, basically. I find it really weird how he goes from being not Bond in Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace to being really bored of being Bond in Skyfall.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, he's constantly quitting. He doesn't want the job whatsoever.
Yeah, there should be something in the gap where he actually has fun as Bond. Yeah. And I do find that weird. But yeah, absolutely. The idea that we can get, well, we did that. And the idea that he can have an antagonistic relationship with them, well, we've done that. The idea that he can suffer and be conflicted, yeah, we did that. I think the relationship with women are way better in Dalton's movies.
Absolutely.
Way, way better. More, you know, they're more fleshed out characters and they're treated better. And so
who's amiable.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it absolutely kills me when people say now, oh, it's the first time we've ever seen Bond dark and doing his own thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Being, you know, like having real emotions. Like, have you ever seen License to Kill? Ever?
Well, I think the answer is no. I mean, for years, nobody watched Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah.
That was the Bond that we didn't talk about. That was the black sheep of the Bond family. George Lazenby was rubbish. He was so rubbish they got rid of him. That's not true, but that's what people said. And, you know, it took probably VHS for people, because it was never on TV, to actually start watching this. And people went, you know what? This is a bloody good movie. In fact, this is a really good movie. And that Lazenby chap, he's not bad, really.
No.
Oh, so true.
And it's a shame he didn't stick around.
Absolutely.
It's not to sort of say that the Craig stuff is bad because it's been done before, because we like stuff that's been done before. Yeah. It's not so much having a go at the films, it's more the sort of reaction to them, like you said, Rob, the meme. It's not having a go at Daniel Craig. It's easy to, you know, oh yeah, that was done before.
I'm aware that a lot of the listeners to the podcast think that I'm very anti-Craig.
Gave you that opinion?
I think Craig is a fabulous, fabulous actor. I really do. But I think this incarnation of Bond and the direction of the Bond franchise is all that's gone wrong. I think that's really where we are. I mean, look, we could go right back to the very beginning of this episode of the two, however many segments we separate this conversation into, to say that Bond is not in the present, current conscious of people. It's just not. It's a historical record.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the more that you have it coming out six times a year in such a convoluted way as it is, the longer it will be a historical relic. Maybe that's what it is now. Maybe the stuff that we all loved about Bond is history. Maybe it is. I don't know.
We're lucky that if we don't like the new ones, that we have such a rich amount of movies that we can celebrate and enjoy. And it's always a problem with franchises. They get reinvented, they develop. I mean, you think about Batman, just to draw a parallel, because I'm a big Batman fan. You know, and once upon a time, I thought Adam West was stupid. Now I realise Adam West was a goddamn genius. And it's immense. But, you know, I love Michael Keaton as well. And I like the Christian Bale ones, but I might not like the next one. And the answer is I just won't watch the damn things. That's fine. you know. And
don't need to get offended. Unless you're so invested. I mean, we're so invested in Bond. We're so excited.
Yeah, we want them to be good.
There is potential to be good.
You go in and you get disappointed. I remember that with Die Another Day. I was really furious.
Oh, yeah.
And because the trailers were pretty good, I was really thought
they were amazing, weren't they?
It was going to be great. And I remember watching being in the cinema and the excitement in the cinema when the trailer came on, and it looked way more fun. And it almost like they'd edited some of the fun bits out when the final film came out. And I just thought, this is. And then the car's invisible, and there's the whole surfing.
You kept that one out of the trailer for a reason.
I love how you've given They Feast a real pass there, Carrie. Yeah.
But, you know, that's actually really butt point, because up to that point, it's not a terrible movie. It's got
I agree.
That's a real flashing light, isn't it?
And it's just like, what is They Feast? And what's the knife and the fruit about? I mean...
Glad it exists.
I can't. That's the one. I can show bits of other movies to the kids, but I can't. I mean, this is a dirty great orgasm in the middle of another day. I can't show my children this. I mean, it's a disgrace.
I can show them Crest's head blowing up. That's fine. But
Absolutely.
Can't show them this.
Embarrassing watching the rude bit.
Hi, this is Andreas Wisniewski, and you're listening to Really 007.
We did say we'd mention a bit the parallels with Batman. I hadn't thought about this really, but of course, Batman 89, the right, let's take it much darker, same year as License to Kill. And then 2005, Batman Begins, 2006, Casino Royale. It's like, this is the new down-to-earth Batman. We've never seen this before, but actually we have.
I think the
difference is that, of course, the Nolan films have humour in them. Do you know what I mean? They're more loving and they've got more... I don't want to completely do down on the Craig films.
No, because, I mean, Casino Royale is terrific. I think it's a really good movie. And I, when I saw that, I was absolutely blown away by it. And the action in it is terrific. The relationship with Vesper is well done. It maybe goes on a bit little long in places, but, you know, it pushes stuff. The torture scene is an interesting scene that they were willing to go that far and put that in. I think it was a really interesting thing to do. But you're right to say that, you know, everything new has got a precedent, you know. I mean, I do, when I'm teaching, I do, you know, story structure and archetypal characters. And, you know, because students being the way they are, and you know, a lot of them don't know old stuff. So they go, okay, let's look at Harry Potter. Well, you know, Harry Potter is basically the same as Star Wars. You know, the Star Wars is basically the same as Lord of the Rings, and Lord of the Rings is basically King Arthur. And you go through all of these things. And the story structure's underpinned. So, things go in, the zeitgeist shifts. The Bonds, the Craig Bonds are heavily influenced by the Bourne movies, obviously. And, you know, Quantum of Solace uses Dan Bradley, who was the action coordinator on the Bourne movies. They've always absorbed the zeitgeist as it shifted around. The problem is how do you retain a core identity and move with the zeitgeist? Because there's a point maybe you move too far, and then you lose the core identity and then you're something else entirely. But yeah, I mean, the Batman films are more able to reinvent because they have no even loose continuity. We're just starting again constantly. Hmm. I think it's going to be really interesting after Craig finishes, because this is, you know, his last movie. Is the next Bond the same Bond, or do we reboot again? How does that work? Because I was thinking about this, because Casino Royale, like I say, I love, but it does paint you into a bit of a corner. Is that...
Yeah, it should have been a one-off, we were saying.
Yeah, and then you could have just come back to... Oh, well, yeah, no, yeah. But then if you're going to have Judi Dench's M in that then confuses the hell out of everything.
Yes, yeah.
But I think, like, Bond audiences are quite forgiving in terms of the timeline, as we said earlier on.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, I wouldn't have a solitary problem just assuming that if Casino Royale was a one-off, I wouldn't have any problem at all assuming that, look, how cool is this? We've got, like, a early days Bond earning his stripes movie, and then we're back into... Daniel Craig's Bond doing all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah. Before he's too old in Skyfall.
Yeah, well, like... absolutely, if they'd gone on... and I didn't mind Quantum of Solace having that I thought that's quite interesting, picking up the movie straight after the last Bond film.
Bold, definitely bold.
And really bold and really interesting, and the car chase and stuff. But again, it's sort of like, okay, and now he's James Bond at the end of it. Okay. So why can't I have a gun barrel at the start of Skyfall then if he's James Bond? Because I want my gun barrel.
Absolutely.
Where's my gun barrel? I demand my fucking gun barrel.
Yeah, yeah. Too much, do it.
Is that a famously hill you will die on, Kerry?
You know what? It's
Spectre's got on though. So
it's a really important moment in a Bond movie, and I can see why they didn't do it in Casino Royale. But it sets the feel and the tone and the music, and it's a ritualistic thing. It's a really important thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I want it back. And
I'm very, you know, I sound like an absolute authoritarian idiot or whatever here. It's a non-negotiable for me. It's there. It goes in. And yeah, yes, I can see why they did it in Casino Royale, but then that then just gives you free license. Oh, you can mess about with that now. You can stick it at the end, you know, you can do this, that, and the other. And then if you bring in someone like Sam Mendes, well, I'm not going to be bound by, you know, the rules of what's gone before. I think, you know, it's something that you need right at the start. You get the Bond theme, you get your actor. If it's his first time, you get to see him as Bond straight away, even if you then don't, you know, see him in the action straight away. The elements are just sort of gradually sort of stripped away, and then they're trying to put them back, but they're not in the right order. Yeah.
Have that, but always have the theme song, title sequence? You know, that's surely far more jarring. Yeah. It splits up the film. I don't, you know.
Agree, Tom. I've never thought about it like that. Like how much more jarring it is to have a 4-minute title sequence in a film at the 20-minute mark rather than just a 4-second gun barrel at the start.
Yeah. Yeah,
but without sounding like cynical, you're talking about a company that struggled to make ends meet, and you look at then like the last few times they've just got the most popular artist to do the song. It's a way of making money, isn't it? That's the
I mean
thing.
That starts actually, and again, this is not against the Sheryl Crow theme, but that starts really with Tomorrow Never Dies. It's like, how do we engage sort of an MTV younger audience? Because GoldenEye makes money, but it's kind of okay, your dad likes it, so how do we get that? That's why Garbage.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's not enough. Yeah. And Madonna, bless her.
Tom's a defender.
I didn't mind the song. Whether it belongs in the movie is a different question, but I don't mind the song. And
it's a funny movie, so it's a funny song.
I'm much more worried about a cameo than I am about the song.
Well,
it could be a brilliant end credits sequence song.
Dun, dun, dun,
dun, really good.
Dun, so Bond.
But I thought, like, when I heard horrendous. The title, you know, I heard the...
Don't listen to them, John.
I thought she'd go with a ballad, you know?
Yeah, it's so unpredictable, isn't it?
Yeah, but no, she's going, like, full techno.
Well, it's like it's very much like Music, which everyone...
Well, whatever, that's what I was going to say.
Massive hit, but now, oh no, it's silly music, even though it's pretty much straight from the song.
I think it's another example of your hand. You know, I'm a bit more of, I'm not as angry at that song, although, you know, but it's again, it's so another good. Thing. You're handing something over that's to someone who's not going to be as bothered about the, you know, the heritage and the machine of Bond and the you know, everything like that. And then, so she'll just do what she wants. And then you can't say no. You can't say, no, sorry, Madonna, we're not actually having this song.
That's it.
Yeah.
So it's another example that's gradually been, in my opinion, eroded. Yeah.
No, I think it's true, and I think it is absolutely about the synergy of the marketing and how we target different audiences, how we get play, whether it's on MTV. I guess is MTV even a thing anymore? But it was certainly back in the '90s. You know, how do we get YouTube hits? And you know, Billie Eilish's song, you know, whether we like it or not, that's a definite decision to target a younger demographic and a female demographic.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you're spending $200-300 million on a movie. Yep. What are you going to do? Although I sometimes beggar's belief when I watch the movie, I think I can see a lot of money, but $200-300 million?
Yeah. Well, sometimes... John Glenn got more bang for his buck, didn't he? Good grief.
Well, absolutely. And and like we mentioned the Mission Impossible movies, they cost about half that. They're doing it for $50 million. And the last one, we had some Bond stunt, you know, they had a Halo jump, for God's sake. We've seen that before. Some, you know, really Bondian moments. And you think, oh, why is it costing so much? And why is it taking so long? It is, but we're frustrated fans, aren't we? We just want a Bond movie.
To come back to these two films, it's just like everything seems to have led up to these two, and particularly License to Kill, like you say, it's almost an end of an era where it cannot get any better. And a GoldenEye is terrific, and I don't think that could have been a better reboot. Not a reboot in terms of the character, but the franchise. The Dalton, like they say, the Brosnan franchise, I think we were very lucky to have it.
I think we're very blessed
to have that.
And the best video games, you know, some of the best video games, obviously
we GoldenEye. We need them back as well.
64, but Everything or Nothing is fab.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. I haven't played that in years. That's a terrific game.
Did you play? Have you ever played the tie-in? Well, it wasn't quite a tie-in. The License to Kill, was it like James Bond 007 or some generic?
There was a couple of ones. There was a License to Kill game that was on things like the Commodore 64 and the Amstrad. Which is a top-down scrolling game where there's a helicopter level and stuff. There was 007 the Duel, was on the Sega whatever.
Mega Drive, I think.
Never got to play that. Never. No. Yeah, one of them.
But nothing to do with Sanchez. There's no...
Yeah, the end level, you have to set him alight.
Right, well, that brings it, Kerry, to the 007 Legends game, which License to Kill is featured in, but Moonraker is a prominent part of that game, isn't it?
It is. And for some strange reason, I am in that level, which is quite nice because I was born in 79 and Moonraker is...
'79
But it's a weird story. There was a competition on the 007 Legends when it was announced. They had a website, and the day before the competition closed, I saw this and I thought, "Oh well, I'll have a go." And you had to write an idea, a Bond villain, and upload a photo. And I had a wonderful photo my wife had done. One of the movies I've researched is Straw Dogs, which is fascinating and difficult.
Oh, wow,
interesting. Skyfall.
Can we do another podcast on that?
Yeah, we could do. But if you know the poster for Straw Dogs, it's a really interesting poster. Yeah. There's nothing with cracked glasses. And my wife, who's a brilliant photographer, had done a picture of me with an old pair of glasses that I'd sort of smashed and that cracked.
Oh.
So that was my Bond villain picture. And I had to write a Bond villain. His last name was Killfeather, which is a real name, Killfeather, which I saw on a notice board at university. And I thought, well, I'm stealing that name the future. That's like the most Bond villain name I've ever heard. So, and Killfeather, I can't remember what I wrote particularly. But anyway, two people won. I won, and a guy in America. And I had to have dots put on my face. My wife took loads of pictures, and they digitized me into the game. And I'm not in space, sadly. I'm on the Earth side of the Moonraker level.
But all right.
There is a particular corridor where you get to slap me silly if you want to. The best bit is I'm in the multiplayer. So you can play me. I'm a playable character in multiplayer.
This is amazing.
Four people playing me, shooting me. and of course, this is on the PlayStation 3. I've got a copy. I don't have a PlayStation 3 anymore, stupidly. But, you know, I've had friends, you know, just literally slapping my avatar. And so if you look for the Drax henchman in the game, that's me. And it's really a weird honor. It's not the best James Bond game ever, sadly, but it's fun. And it's fun to be Daniel Craig to shoot you in a video game or whatever. He does laser you. So it's a bizarre thing, but it's cool.
I've just, while you were talking there, Kerry, I've just found it pre-owned on Amazon. I've just bought it.
Oh, well, I'm not saying I'm not saying it's good.
No, we've got a PS3 in the front rooms.
It's a weird movie, actually. And if you think about the Craig continuity, it's an interesting thing. So at the start of Skyfall when Craig falls off. And the idea is while James Bond is drowning or whatever, he's remembering his past adventures. And it writes Goldfinger, Moonraker, Honor Majesty's Secret Service, License to Kill, and Die Another Day into the Craig continuity.
It's just what choices? So mad,
Die Another Day.
Yeah, Die Another Day.
So,
well, it's a video game, ready-made video game, isn't it?
Yeah. And so it's a bizarre game. But yeah, I sat with friends. I took it in students and let them shoot me as well. They found that quite. But yeah, it's a cool thing to have done. It's just random, and it's just look. I saw the website and I wrote something, and it happened. So either I was brilliant, or I'm the one person in Britain who saw it. And
destined to be a big player in the Bond universe.
Well, absolutely, and it's a bit of an omen. And I do love Moonraker as well, so that was kind of a cool. Because Moonraker's fabulous, isn't it?
It's class.
It's great. It's great fun.
It's full on Roger Moore. I actually prefer it to Spy Who Loved Me, although it's very similar to Spy. I think. I know, controversial. But I think Moonraker is like purely 100% Roger Moore Bond all the way through, over the top, just batshit crazy film.
Carrie, I might be pushing towards agreeing with you these days.
Yeah,
I didn't used to, but
the
more I watch John Barry as well.
John Barry really adds something.
Oh, he always adds. But, and you know what? Some of the special effects are actually really good. The rocket launches and the Ken Adams sets are so good.
It knows what it is, though, doesn't it? Yes. That's the thing. It's very self-aware. It knows it's silly at parts, and it's happy to go along with that. And it's you can
exotic.
Appreciate that. Oh, it's very exotic.
It is exotic.
It's exciting. It's an adventure movie. It's
absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. And
with a gondola.
but you got to laugh though at the gondola and the pigeon and
his straight
face. The bloke with the, you know, I love that bloke who turns up in three of John Glenn. You have to ask John Glenn about, you know, people looking at drinks.
Oh yeah,
the drink guy.
I love the drink. And all those sorts of things, because those silly little touches, but they're a lot of fun. And they're really important, I think, to that. So yeah, Moonraker's great.
Brilliant.
So, you know, discussion on the gritty, realistic films ends with Moonraker.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But you know, but I would settle for a Moonraker. You know, no time like that. It's like Moonraker. I'd settle for that. Because it is fun, and look, I love License to Kill, and you know, it is my favourite Bond film, and I think it's a superb film because of the dramatic depth, and the action is, and we've not really talked about the action, but the action is superb. It is insane. The tanker trace is just brilliant. The full burn that the stuntman does at the end, I think it's Southern Western, maybe, but that is so dangerous, and it was cut in the original UK release, which is scandalous, really. Because the stuntman deserves us to watch.
Yes,
him on fire. Because
it was a big thing at the time in the sort of press junkets that I remember being told by my older brother. You know, like this guy was actually burned. He was actually burned a lot. No, you know, he didn't die, but this was like the first time it had ever been done this real. Yeah, like, his whole body, his head, everything.
Absolutely,
it's just incredible.
You could have had everything.
Don't you want to know why?
And the payoff with the lighter, and it just ends the perfect film in a perfect way, doesn't it?
And the structure of that, and you talked earlier about the payoff with Pam, with the, you know, why did you ask me?
Yeah.
That, again, everything pays off that is set up. It all comes round again, and nothing feels tacked on and retconned in
or
it's like the end of a Spectre where you just like, okay, this feels like we've added an extra scene to try and tie everything up.
Yeah,
yeah.
It just sits whole into itself and it works so beautifully. And Moonraker.
And then you're on a light note.
in a very different way. But that's the amazing thing about the Bond franchise, is you can have Moonraker and you can have License to Kill. I mean, that's mad, really.
No, yeah, it's
both follow the same
crazy.
That would be, if you could choose a representative movie of each Bond, I guess you'd go with probably Goldfinger for Connery. I guess that's the one that sets it. Maybe Moonraker and then License to Kill. You watch those three back to back and you throw in on a Majesty's Secret Service. You are all over the place as a franchise. But that's kind of beautiful in its own.
I still feel like I'm hitting the right notes, the notes that mean something to me.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, I mean, we have Kick Spectre and Skyfall a bit today, and I,
surprise,
without going on too much, I think that there
are
those...
Welcome to my nuclear family. No, sorry. We do that regularly, but
they try and hit some of those beats in Spectre and it doesn't pay off. It's like a train fight, which is quite good, but it doesn't make sense because if he's supposed to go there, why are you trying to kill him?
Yeah, yeah. In isolation.
Yeah, It feels like things to, you know.
Yeah.
It's like the gadgets in the car, you know, the car chase, I don't think really works, but the idea isn't a terrible one. It's just a bit flat in execution. And then, you know, the brother thing, but, you know, move on. I'm glad it upsets other people, because I thought, you know, you do wonder if it's just yourself. It's just like, you know, I know that annoys me is it's not in Fleming. If you're going to go back to Bond's past, you should stick with Fleming, because he set that. You know, he didn't go there. And you don't need Blofeld to have a link to Bond. Blofeld is, it's okay. Blofeld's just the bad guy. I think there's this desire in writing and franchises where everything has to always link up to everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really, you know, and we've discussed this quite a lot, but firstly, if you're having Blofeld, then and you're making a big thing of him, making him the villain of the film, and then do it, then say it from the start, have him from the start. Don't pussyfoot around it. You know, I think, you know, so for example, like in The Dark Knight, we all knew that Heath Ledger was going to be the Joker, and he's the Joker all the way through it. It's not like, oh well, no, we won't actually call him the Joker. We won't say anything, you know. Well, you know, and then so firstly, that was one problem I had with it, that they did a bit like what they did with Star Trek Into Darkness, and they tried to conceal it, but not sort of, you know. Well, I don't know what, you know. The thing is, it doesn't mean anything to those characters, so it's just to the audience. If you know what
yes, I mean. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
It's only a surprise. So when he says, "My, you know, I've been going by the name Ernst Stavro Blofeld," like Daniel Craig's Bond says, you know, catchy name or so, I can't remember. But then the brother thing, to try and do that. I mean, I don't think you should ever do the villain of it being Bond's stepbrother or anything in any circumstances. But to make him also Blofeld is. You know, it's a crime punishable by...
It does. And look, if you're going to call your film Spectre, anybody knows anything about it.
Yeah, I know, yeah. It's just...
They even have the octopus. And the logo is quite cool with the bullet hole and the octopus.
Yeah, great.
It's amazing. I thought you'd say you prefer the Quantum Organisation.
You've cast Christoph Waltz. So, who is he going to be? Really?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just so you're not.
But then he gets arrested as soon as he's done something. But
it's lazy. It's lazy.
Yeah.
It's a lazy. If you can't write drama into something, then the quickest way to get drama is you add a family connection.
Or something
like that. And that suddenly you've got your drama ready made. It is lazy.
Yeah, I agree. I would have been fine with Quantum being Spectre. But I particularly dislike trying to retcon Skyfall into that context.
Yeah.
Because if you think about Dr. No, From Russia with Love, then Goldfinger sits outside and then Thunderball brings Spectre back.
Yeah.
So Skyfall could have just sit on its own and we could have gone back.
Yeah. I think they originally intended that.
Why did they have to be linked?
Because it was the most popular film.
Blofeld wouldn't have had enough posters to put on the wall.
That's very true. Either way, we've got License to Kill and Living.
They're bloody brilliant.
Can I ask you, Kerry, how often do you watch them, those two films?
Well, I watch them back to back Sunday for this, and I can't remember. I mean, I go through periods where I watch Bond films quite a lot, and then I don't. And it depends, and again, if they're on TV so much, I end up watching like half of Octopussy once every 2 weeks, possibly in Britain. It's on a lot. That's not a bad thing necessarily.
No, it's not.
I just come back to them every now and then, you know, a couple of times a year probably. And obviously, if I'm going to talk to guys like yourselves, I'll put them on and check them out. But I quite like giving them a bit of space.
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Then they surprise me again and they excite me again.
Yeah.
When I rewatch them. But I mean, when I was young, I just watched them.
But it is video nice just to, ruined. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice to let them sit and then see them anew. And I need to go. I still haven't been able to see either of them on the big screen, which is really depressing. And I need to be able to do that.
I think now, coming back, is it the Prince Charles? I don't think I'll be able to do that,
which is really frustrating, because I would love to see. It's great watching old movies. I went down to the National Film Theatre ages ago and watched Superman the movie with an audience.
Dear.
And it was a beautiful restored print.
Oh,
it was the best time I've had, because everybody laughed and cheered.
And got into it.
It was such a wonderful time. So it would be great to go and see these movies that way and see them anew on the big, because they're designed, they're filmed to be big. And I'm not, you know.
Yeah. At least they've resisted that, you could say, with No Time to Die. They are trying to wait to have it as a theatre moment.
Yeah. And, you know, I really think that we've seen a massive, and you know, I absolutely love TV series, you know, limited series, long running series, but a film is an event.
Yeah.
It's like, it's, you know, a film like a Bond film is an event that people should anticipate, and then you go, and then you might go again to the cinema to see it, or you know, you then wait for it to come on and then you can watch it. Whereas it's very difficult to rewatch the whole of a TV series constantly. Or I know some people do some, but it's very unlikely.
That, I think that's generation. My daughter does that.
Yeah, but how many TV series? You know,
quite a lot, I think.
Fair enough.
But it's really interesting, and you know, 17 issues, and you know, she's of what they call digital natives. So kids who have grown up with digital technology, they don't know any different. They don't know what it's like to put a tape into a machine to try and load a Commodore 64 game for 20 minutes that then crashes after the squiggly line moves 2 inches. And we sound old, but we'll move on. But she does watch series again and again, and you know, she loves Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and she's watched that God knows how many times.
So like I say, a film, it's just...
I agree, the event and the ritualization that goes into the, not just the film, but the cinema.
Yeah.
Cinemas are great, wonderful places. We have a couple of... We have decent cinema in Boston. The Savoy Cinema is a nice one, but we have a couple of really special cinemas here. We have an Everyman in Lincoln, which is...
Oh, yeah, they're great. Yeah.
They're beautiful places. But we have a place in Woodall Spa called the Kinema in the Woods, which is basically a cinema as if the 1950s hasn't stopped. They have an intermission, and they have a lady bring you ice creams if you want.
There we go.
Every film needs an intermission.
A Stretch Hero, Michael Kamen.
And cinemas are beautiful places, and I had a lot of really great memories. I mean, the cinema I went to as a kid, which burned down, ironically, after being turned into a nightclub called Flames.
Sounds brilliant. Was actually turn of the millennium.
It was a dreadful cinema. It was a proper sticky floor, flappy theatre seats. I'm sure the screen was slightly yellow because you know people had smoked so much in there.
Spectre would have gone down well.
There was one. I'm sure there was one massive speaker behind the screen. But some of my best memories are going to watch, you know, GoldenEye. There for the second time. First movie I watched twice in the cinema. They had a very loose age restriction policy there, so Trainspotting, Pulp Fiction, Leon,
Crikey.
All these sorts of movies I got to watch when I was clearly underage, but it was a really good time. So, you know, cinema's bloody brilliant. Love this.
Yeah.
And we might be going next week to see, my wife is a horror fan, so the new Saw movie, I think I might I might be in to see.
Chris Rock and Samuel L. Jackson. So
it's
interesting.
A weird idea, isn't it?
Yeah,
why not?
No way those things should work. But...
Yeah, so we'll see if they do.
Oh, love it, absolutely love it. Yeah, so thank you, Carrie, for joining us.
Mm.
Like we say, the book is brilliant.
Thank you very much.
Again, viewers and listeners, if you haven't read it, then please do. It's fairly brief and it's fairly to the point, and it's you can read it in a couple of hours. It's absolutely brilliant. And of course, if you're coming into it from loving Dalton and loving the Bond, well, you're going to love it. But I think for people who maybe are a little bit reticent on the Dalton years, especially, if you read this, it just gives you a bit of that what was going on at the time, what was going on in like the 80s. And the background to it, and the themes that run through it that perhaps you didn't get the first time. I can't recommend it enough. And I think you've heard Carey, obviously he knows his stuff, and he is a Bond fan. He loves James Bond.
Absolutely.
And that's the main thing. All of us, that's why we're here. And we can only be positive about these films. So thank you, Carey, for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
absolutely loved it.
Great to meet you, Carey.
Yeah, and you guys. And it would be great to speak again if you want to do a scene-by-scene analysis.
Really, Douglas.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.